March 8th, beginning at midnight. WPFW, Building a Better World, one broadcast at a time.
Hello, I'm Dr. E. Faye Williams, National Chair of the National Congress of Black Women. And you're tuned to member-supported WPFW Washington.
This is a journey.
Would you join me, please, in welcoming me?
Redeem a full of culture.
I got so much trouble on my mind. Refuse to lose. Here's your ticket.
Welcome, welcome, welcome to the Collision. Ooh, the opening theme ended a little early this week. That's okay. I'm Dave Zirin, about to be joined by Etan Thomas and Chuck Modiano, coming to you live and direct from Washington, D.C. We have so much to share with you this week. No shortage of things to share with you, honest and true. We are going to be speaking this week about so much. We are going to be speaking to you about what is happening here in our Washington, D.C. with the painting over of Black Lives Matter Plaza. And I'm sure people have heard about what's happening there at Black Lives Matter Plaza. Muriel Bowser talking about painting it over. And we have Chuck Modiano to speak about that. And Chuck, there's no one I would rather hear about this from Chuck, at least nobody in our WPFW family, because Chuck was down there like 3 a.m. talking to people before it existed, when it was painted on, some of the, shall we say, contradictions of its existence in the Bowser mayorally period, and then also the significance of Bowser pledging to paint it over following threats from this radical right Republican Congress. And we're going to try to cover all of that. Also, man, we got Etan Thomas with us this week. So happy about that. He's with us. We've missed him for the last couple. 10-year NBA veteran, author of numerous books, all of which are terrific, all of which I have read. And they are books that everybody out there should read, too. And they're about athletes. They're about fatherhood. They're about Black pride. They're about dignity. And they're also about struggle and the glories thereof. So glad to have you guys here. We're going to talk to Etan Thomas about recent comments by Charles Barkley about why athletes should accept invitations to go to this Trumpist White House. Etan's thoughts about that and the opinion about the subject that Etan received from one Mahmoud Abdul-Rauf, one of my heroes. So Etan Thomas, how you doing, sir?
I'm doing pretty good, Dave. How you doing?
Good. You sound terrific, man. Loud and clear.
Loud and clear? All right, that's good.
Terrific. And Chuck Modiano, how are you doing, my man?
I'm doing great. Am I loud and clear?
Well, loud. No, just kidding. Well, I told y'all guys we got a full agenda. We want to talk about what's happening at BLM Plaza. We want to talk about Barkley's comments because they have actually very strong immediate repercussions about athletes visiting the White House because of a lot of controversy happening right now about the Philadelphia Eagles following their Super Bowl win. We also really do want to get to talking to Chuck about some of the recent struggles that are taking place, because a lot of times all you get is the woe is me, especially in this Trump era of constant attacks, particularly on our community here in the DMV with the attacks on federal workers and the ripple effect that has, not to mention tourism, by the way. And we want to talk about that And Chuck, though, has some real interesting things to say about the way people are pushing back. And hey, if we get through all that, let's talk about the LeBron Lakers and whether JJ Redick should be getting consideration for coach of the year right now, which is not something I would thought I would say in March of 2025 when he was the second hiring after. And I'm sure they're very relieved about this. And I know it's on. I know you think they're relieved about this. About Dan Hurley walking away from the table. Remember that, Atan?
I do. I definitely do.
And I know your opinions about Hurley are something. So can you imagine Hurley barking at LeBron and Luka like that?
Oh, goodness. That would not work at all.
Good gracious. Jackson Hayes communicating with him. That young man, that would be tough. But let's start with an issue that's certainly rocking this area, rocking the WPFW family. And it's the broader issue of what will happen to Washington, D.C., what will happen to home rule, what will happen to our independence and dignity with this new Republican House and Donald Trump pledging to attack home rule every which way but loose, even pulling it out from us under our feet. And the starting point of that certainly seems to be the threat to defund all transportation funds for Washington, D.C., unless BLM Plaza is not only painted over, but renamed. And Bowser's willingness is certainly to, it looks like, that she is going to do that on the painting over. The rename thing is still a question, but I'm sure that's going to happen as well. Chuck Modiano, give us a sense of the history, if you will, of BLM Plaza and talk about how you see the significance today of the probable painting over and the possible renaming.
You know, absolutely, DZ. And let me just hit a couple points of sort of how we got here. We know how Trump is. He's just a gangster, you know, threatens everybody. And that was followed up with by a bill by Andrew Clyde. Congressman Andrew Clyde said, Trump is 100% right. We must clean up Washington, D.C. This is in a resolution, and he's making comments. I believe removing BLM Plaza must be part of this critical effort. After all, BLM is a radical defund the police organization, and we are not a defund the police nation. Yet the left has allowed this deeply divisive slogan, Black Lives Matter Plaza is that deeply divisive slogan, to shamefully stain the streets of America's capital city for nearly 5 years. And he goes on. So you get the gist of what is happening here. And essentially Bowser's response is, and she has a bigger statement. I'm not going to say the bigger statement, but we have bigger fish to fry. And if you just took it on its value, let's analyze that. Let me take off my activist hat and put on my pragmatic hat. She mentions we're losing thousands of jobs, which is true. Because of what Trump is doing, and she goes on about it. So the pragmatists say, okay, maybe you got real stuff to deal with, a home rule, and he's coming after housing encampments, which you have previously done yourself. So let's take her at her own logic.
So to be clear, Chuck, when you say you mean Mayor Bowser, not me, Dave Zirin.
Let's take Dave Zirin, Mayor Bowser, and Donald Trump.
It made it sound like you were saying I was doing it, man.
Let's take Dave Zirin and Donald Trump at their own combined in synergistic logic. Yes,
and let's do that. I won't interrupt again. Sorry.
No, that was a good interruption. So I'm going to go to Free DC, one of the many great organizations in DC that does work. And here was their response, and it was in a thread. It said, one of the things we talk a lot about in organizing is the importance of not obeying in advance. History teaches us that authoritarian leaders will use intimidation and fear to try to get people to obey in advance because it's just a lot easier than forcing people to comply. And it sure looks like Clyde's new bill is about trying to intimidate DC more than anything. Clyde's bill is threatening to hold federal funds hostage if we don't give him what he wants. That's not about a street name. That's about trying to make an entire city feel fearful to garner compliance. Compliance in advance to a bill like this, which has zero co-sponsors and might never even have a hearing, much less pass, sends a message to Clyde and his allies that all they need to do to make an empty threat and we will comply. That is an incredibly bad position to take. So that's what Free DC is saying. I happen to agree with Free DC. And then to add in the history. Now, let's look at the history of Bowser. Bowser has a very specific history. Every time the right wing, the extreme right wing attacks them, and they do that because, you know, Bowser's a black woman. They know about how it's going to play to their base. But in reality, and how she governs, she's very right wing in herself, from the stop and frisk laws to how she treats protesters to a whole number of things. But what Bowser has done, most recently, in 2024, there was a hearing. Lauren Boebert and these right-wingers came to the GW encampments and said, we're going to have a hearing. Bowser's not doing anything about these protesters. And they had a hearing scheduled. And the night before the hearing, Bowser had her MPD raid that encampment, brutalize those protesters, arrest them en masse, get them off the street for months. And then the meeting was canceled. You see, she complied in advance. If you go back to the George Floyd protests, we saw that a lot, where there were these times that anytime she was threatened, she did Trump's work for him, and sometimes worse. So there were moments like, famously, there were 200 people arrested at Swan Street early on, the Swan Street kettle, over 400 in the first 4 days. How did that happen? Trump made threats. Trump's goons came. He brought the National Guard. But what Bowser did is implement a curfew at 7 p.m. So right after 7 p.m., that's when the brutality started. That's when the mass arrests started. That's when everybody was beaten, and it couldn't have happened legally without Bowser's capitulation on the curfew. Now, let's fast forward to August 31st that same year. August 13th and 14th that same year, August 30th, Bowser kettles 41 protesters in 2020, arbitrarily kettles. You got medics in there, journalists in there. And then when Trump's people aren't going to believe this, when Trump's people do not want to prosecute because they're like, there's no evidence, you just arbitrarily kettled 41 people. Her response to Trump's people, namely Michael Sherwin, was to say, you're not prosecuting hard enough. She was chastising them in a letter on September 1st that they need to prosecute the protesters harder. This is Bowser's history. She either caves or goes harder, I suspect, for her own career. But if you understand Bowser's history, then you know her logic that we got bigger fish to fry and we are picking our battles. That falls apart because she's never picked any battle in her life, no matter how big or how small. When Republicans come after her, she capitulates them on whatever it is, no matter what. So when you capitulate on the letters Black Lives Matter in the street, it makes me concerned about everything else that comes after that, including home rule.
It never stops with one thing, does it?
It never stops. You give them an inch and they try to take a mile.
Just ask Travis Kelce about that. We talked about that last week. That's a whole other question of from the Super Bowl attacking this special lady friend. I know that's a different issue. But go to you, Etan, please. Any thoughts that you want to share about Mayor Bowser, the painting over of the plaza, possibly changing the name, the significance or symbolism of that, and how you think of it as like the pragmatic? Is that, in fact, pragmatic strategy?
Ooh, I mean, that was a lot to take in.
It really is.
Chuck really laid it all out. I mean, I don't even know where to start. You know, I mean, it's the bullying of Trump and the Trump administration and the capitulating to that.
Mm-hmm.
Definitely something that deserves to be highlighted and examined, because everything with Trump is smoke and mirrors.
Mm-hmm.
Makes these threats, and if nobody says anything, then it goes through.
Mm-hmm.
If nobody speaks out against it, if nothing else happens, then it goes through. And that's why it's so important not to capitulate to everything that he says and just cower, because a lot of times he will cower if you speak up.
Mm-hmm.
It was interesting watching the State of the Union, okay? And there's no other way to say it, but he honored a young child that had brain cancer, if you saw that.
Yes.
He held him up. They gave him a standing, ovation and everything like that. But when you dig a little deeper, this is all while he is, you know, ending the funding to cancer research.
Mm-hmm.
And so you have a federal judge or a federal court that blocked the some of his funding cuts. But if the judge wouldn't have done that, if people wouldn't have, spoke up against it, if pressure the judge, pressure whatever thing else, he would have just gone ahead with it. Same with the cutting of the funds to HBCUs. And then the one, I'm escaping his name right now, but in Georgia, he pushed against it after pressure from the people of saying, no, we can't have this. So it's like every single time that Trump makes these threats and he tries to do something and he wants to do something outlandish, it's so important for people to resist it and not to just capitulate to everything that he said.
I'm so glad you said that. I'm sorry, continue.
No, go ahead.
I'm so glad you said that because the strategy, I've said this over and over again, that what is killing us right now is not Trump and these executive orders. What is killing us is not Elon Musk and Doge. What is killing us is the voluntary compliance or the voluntary complicity. People doing it either out of fear, and I'll put Bowser in that category, or doing it because there's some kind of multi-billionaire oligarch who now finally feel like they're free and finally can let their freak flag fly. And I'm talking about people like Jeff Bezos over at the Washington Post. That is what's so hurting us. Or Mark Zuckerberg, that slug who runs Meta. That is what I'm talking about. Like all these organizations and corporate entities and frankly, cultural institutions. Like if people saw the Oscars, you would have thought it would have been this anti-Trump fest. Didn't happen. The Grammys didn't happen. I mean, the sports world, it's so thin right now. Although I do want to give a shout out to, I believe her name is Dejane Arrington, the basketball player. I'm getting her. I don't want to get her name wrong. Dejane Arrington. Uh-huh. She's spoken out, and I got to give her credit, CM Punk and the WWE. But those situations are very few and far between as well, of current athletes, Mahmoud Abdul-Rauf, people like the great Etan Thomas. I'm not including folks who have that history and know the history of that. And I get why in the fear part. Like, imagine you're somebody like, for example, let's just say it, LeBron James. It's like you are so naked out there as a basketball player, and these people are violent. These people are crazy, you know, and you have that fear factor for yourself and for your family. I get that. 1,000%. But then when you get like institutions, forget about the individuals, the institutions that go along with this, Target, for example, abolishing DEI in advance, Google saying, well, okay, we'll call it the Gulf of America right now. All of that serves to depress, demoralize, and confuse people. But this Trump administration, which is run by mediocre white men, largely, oh, they're all mediocre, they're all white. This is something that you see them be very cruel, very awful, very mean, very deadly, if you look at some of what's happening, but also very incompetent and very stupid. And I can give you so many examples about this, from the way ICE is not doing what was promised because a lot of its agents are demoralized. I know this firsthand. A lot of the agents are demoralized. Boo-hoo. And all that FBI and CIA, like people are like creating message boards to talk about how we're going to resist this because everybody's ignorant, stupid, doesn't know how these things run correctly. This dude who's in charge of chopping up USAID, which has its own problems, but I'm not going to that, is this dude named, I believe it's Pete Maraca, who was one of the January 6th rioters. And now he's in charge of dismantling USAID and how many children in sub-Saharan Africa are going to have to die for that. So this is what I'm talking about. Like, resistance is there to be done, but the billionaires see the mega profits. The Muriel Bowsers of the world don't have the spine for this. And the people are left feeling demoralized and confused because, believe me, they want to fight back, but don't know how. and are confused about a direction, about where to go. Now, something is going to break. Something is going to snap because there's just too much anger out there right now. But, and I got to tell you, like giving on this BLM Plaza issue by Bowser, I do think, Chuck, you have your finger on the pulse of this more than I do, and you should say, I do think that's going to demoralize, confuse, upset, make people feel cynical. Yeah, of course, Bowser would do it. Before it sends people out there, I hope I'm wrong about this, but before it sends people out there at 2 a.m. to confront the painting over, to confront a bulldozer, to confront whatever it is that's going to happen to demolish it. Do you know if there are plans around that, or do you know what the gut response has been since this announcement has happened?
I mean, there are two responses. There were people outside last night, outside the plaza talking about that and wanting to defend it. And then there's another part. When you've talked to the activist community, particularly those who were protesting in 2020, they've always said from jump that the BLM Plaza was a farce, that Bowser never stood up to Trump, and that some of the extreme violence that happened on that plaza was under Bowser. I think there was about a 2-week period that, you know, Trump calls in the National Guard and there's violence, but that violence usually happened at like 7 p.m. You could see it in daylight. Every news channel picked it up on, oh my God, Trump's America. And they're all right. I at no point am I like not saying Trump is a gangster, fascist, bully. We know that, right? But what people didn't know is when Trump's goons left, Bowser's MPD were doing a covert Trumpian fascism, but they were doing it 2 a.m. They were raiding the encampments. They were stealing the food and throwing it into dumpster that was mutual aid. They were arresting protesters. The brutality did not change. So everyone said from jump that that was a farce. So it depends on who you are talking to. But what I would say to the broader question is Bowser's capitulation seems to be the Democratic Party's capitulation. Let's not forget that the Senate confirmed Marco Rubio 99-0 to when he was there up for the vote. Let's not forget 46 Democrats joined Republicans on the racist immigration bill of the Lake and Riley Act. Let's not forget that when there were ICE raids in New York City, it came with the full cooperation of Democrat Kathy Hochul, the governor, and Eric Adams, who worked with this right-wing administration to help with those raids. Let's not forget there was a U.S. bill with bipartisan support to target charities and pro-Palestine groups and label nonprofits terror-supporting organizations. These are bipartisan bills. So what we're learning is the uselessness. Maybe they're, to your earlier question, maybe they're on board all the way. Maybe they're weak. I don't even think it matters. The clarity that we have is the people in the streets have to fight in different ways outside the system rather than waiting for saviors who will never come. And I think we are seeing some of that.
Yeah, no, I think it's going to be very interesting, though, like, because for a lot of people, even people who see, and this is, I think, what I would argue with people, Chuck, or at least try to convince people of, is that even if Black Lives Matter Plaza is seen as a sham, even if it's seen as gross hypocrisy by Mayor Bowser, it is also the now, as you put it, the first dent in the process of them trying to destroy the thin metal sheeting that separates home rule from immiseration. And so defending BLM Plaza becomes defending home rule, becomes defending yourself against Trumpist fascism, becomes defending the idea of what this city was supposed to be 50 years ago when the Black freedom struggle fought for not just home rule, but for statehood. I mean, it's about stripping all of that away.
Yes, it's not about paint. We're talking about more than paint.
And it's not about Bowser and her hypocrisies either.
Yeah.
Because it's actually, frankly, doing this is also a resistance to Bowser Act, not just a resistance to Trump.
Yes.
And I just think there's got to be a way, Chuck, for us to amplify that message going forward. I think that's so important. But I digress on this. I think we got to let people know that we're going to be following this issue very closely. We're going to put it out on our social media feeds. If there are actions that are taking place, Chuck, we're going to depend on you to let us know what's taking place. And because I know that a lot of people, including myself, would go out there, and we got to film it. We got to document it. I mean, because this is about the history of this city at this point, not just the history of a plaza or of an individual movement. Oh, one last thing. And then Etan, I'm sorry to go on so long. I'll talk to you. Like, okay. We also really, really need to remember, Chuck, please correct me if I'm wrong about this, but I believe the origins of Black Lives Matter Plaza, of putting the paint down, of the sign, was precisely because of that's where people was gassed, and Trump did that humiliating stand in front of the church that he doesn't attend, holding the Bible upside down, you know, after basically sending in the military to attack U.S. citizens. And I see this like the January 6th pardons as well, like an erasure of one of Trump's most shameless acts that he definitely wants to throw down the memory hole as he goes forward as king of the land, because he rarely looked more pernicious and incompetent on that day.
That, you know, no, that is right. I'm trying to remember the exact chronology of it. I think you might be right. And then you remember, after Black Lives Matter was put there on the street, I think it was June 6th was a demarcation of activists when they said equals defund the police. They wrote Black Lives Matter equals defund the police, which was a big action, because what they wanted to do is, you know, Black Lives Matter is this really broad term, and they wanted to really define it because, you know, police budgets kept, including DC, kept rising, and they wanted to bring it back to the criminal justice fight that was going on for years. People may not know that the greatest solidarity in the Ferguson protests happened in the streets of D.C. and have been fighting that fight. So you have an evolution of what those words actually mean. On the right, they say it's a terrorist organization. Across the board, it's Black Lives Matter, which means everything. But to the activists, it meant that it means we need to defund the police, because that's where it was born out of, really. Ferguson, it was technically born out of Trayvon, but it didn't explode until Ferguson. So it's ties to policing. And, you know, Etan, he wrote a whole entire book on white supremacy and police brutality, and could speak to that. That can't be separated from those letters.
Very true. And that's what they want to erase as well. Etan, before we go to break, just for our audience, because I know we've got a wide listenership, one of the things that Chuck said early on was this congressman from Georgia, who, by the way, if you look him up, I mean, this is somebody I would not scrape from the bottom of my shoe. He said that we have to get rid of like these divisive slogans. What makes Black Lives Matter divisive? That's the one, actually, frankly, even from the perspective of trying to stand in their shoes, it's nothing I can grasp beyond just the assertion of white supremacy and saying that Black lives cannot and should not matter. What is, as your years of looking at this movement and this slogan, could you give any thoughts on that, please?
Oh yeah, it was very simple. It's just weaponized the same day they weaponized the term woke. Now it means something completely different than what it originally meant when it was in the Black community. Now it's transformed into something else, and it's weaponized. That's it, bottom line. And, you know, the defund the police, I mean, you weaponize it to mean something completely different than what it actually, I mean, that's what has been repeatedly happening. So we can't be surprised when it happens again. It's just that we can't accept their new created definition of a term that wasn't created for what they're using it for.
No, exactly. I mean, woke is pretty dead and buried at this point, isn't it, though?
Well, like, they're using it. No, it's not dead and buried.
I don't know either.
Yeah, they use it they weaponized it, and they use it over and over again. Like, they can't stop using it. But they're using their terms and their definition and their recreated definition of it. So, no, it's not dead.
And it's sick the way they're using it now, because, you know, like, they've instructed the EEOC, you know, that's the Equal Opportunity Committee, a very important committee in federal government to look at, even though it moves way too slowly and way too narrowly, but it looks at issues of discrimination in the workplace. It has been directed now under Trump to look at discrimination of white people in the workplace. And when they were asked, like, wait, that's completely opposite its mission. It was created by the John F. Kennedy Civil Rights Bill. You know, it's been a part of this government for over 60 years. What are you talking about? The response was, oh, that's just woke nonsense. So it's a way for them also, and I'm sure Republicans love this, to not actually have to defend their own racism, but brush it off with a keyword that their followers know what it means, wink, wink. And everybody else is like, well, I don't want to be looked at as woke. Like it silences and cows others who otherwise would say something. And that bothers me.
Right.
But I digress. Let's go to break right now. When we come back, the floor is Etan's, because we want to hear not only about Charles Barkley's comments about elections and visiting the White House, but even connect it to something we just talked about and the perniciousness of this idea of voluntary compliance by some of our largest and most loud cultural figures. Let's go to break right now on The Collision here on WPFW, trying to change the world one broadcast at a time.
Might be smoking on something loud. Head to the clouds. I ain't been stepping out. Tired sticking out in the crowd. This world is changing right in front of me. Gray hairs, I'm aging. Flows teach egos to freeze and then reseed. I'm C4 beneath your Jeep. The second you turn that keyhole, the heat blows. Your weak flows right out the water. The father, boy, I work smarter and harder. My style got a restraining order. Don't bother. I charter unseen territories in order to push it farther than you that ever thought of. I caught a lot of murder charges. Turn artists to martyrs. When I rock, that turns to goddess. Fiends turn to kings. Dreams turn to things tangible. My hands are full with grands. I pull from stanzas. No, I can't go slow. I'm Sandra Bull. Either proceed with speed or don't breathe. Snow Creed, a color that won't heed to the warning. The planet will shake when I'm performing. Tectonic plates from a place with text on it waits. So stay safe or get left with chest on your face. As death waits for your last of breath. I'ma pass the test. Yes, I'm a master chef. Wanna taste and pay for it. They claim they're real, but they sell them straight for it. The pain I feel on my frame gets transmuted to a dangerous flame. I spit fire at the devil while the angels sing. The flow changed, but Jermaine's the same. I'm plain Jane out of chain on my neck, but shine light baguettes. Ashamed out of flex to rhyme like the rest. My mind's quite depressed. If I don't write these, I'm Spike Lee at the audio. Back in my barrio. Parties got shot up, so I built up all my cardio. Dodge shells, collect coins like a Mario. But this is not a game and experience, I'm serious.
Straight up, straight up, straight up, straight up, straight up. Smoking on something loud. Head to the clouds, I've been stepping out.
We are back here on The Collision, where sports and politics collide, here at your home for jazz and justice, WPFW, the station that has become more and more essential with each and every passing day. Etan Thomas, what were we just listening to?
Oh, that was J. Cole, a new one from him called Clouds. He's, I'm a big J. Cole fan. He's a lyricist. And you could tell the influence of Nas when you listen to him, but he's really a strong lyricist. So, yep, big up to J. Cole.
Absolutely. You've been in the J. Cole corner for, I think, from jump. So, an OG J. Cole fan. So, Etan Thomas, perhaps talk to us a little bit about Charles Barkley's comments. We'll play them, of course, after you say a few words. And then your article that you just wrote for The Guardian, which is outstanding, that includes an interview with former NBA player Mahmoud Abdul-Rauf. And then we can go around the horn, if you will, and speak about our impressions and what we think it means. So the table is yours, sir.
Sure, sure, sure. And we don't have to play it. I could explain what everything, you know, happened. So basically, you know, after the Philadelphia Eagles won the Super Bowl, there was talk of them refusing going to the White House. Now, there was quotes from different people that were assessed, that were going around, but no official statement was made, so it's still kind of unclear if they're going to go or not. Some places reported that they will go. I don't know if they capitulated to some of the pressure and the outrage that, you know, immediately happened as soon as even the notion that they possibly would not go. You heard that from the right. So basically, Charles Barkley weighed in, and he was doing an interview, and he said that basically that teams should still visit the White House and show respect to the president, regardless of who is in office. So his exact quote, it was right here. He said, "I don't care who the president is. He's the president of the United States. It's bothered me the last 10 years. They're like, well, I'm not going because a certain person is president. Dude, it's the president of the United States. Even though I disagree with the President Trump on some things, if I met him, I would still give him the respect and dignity he deserves. We can disagree, but it bothers me when these teams don't want to go to the White House. I'm just disappointed. We got so divided. Where do we get to as a country where we're like this? Where we're like, we're not going to the White House. We don't like who's in there. That's just stupid." So that's what he said, you know, in complete fashion. So I wanted to speak with someone who I have a great deal of respect for, and that's Mahmoud Abdul-Rauf. And we talked about the topic of athletes speaking out and what he did throughout the interview that you mentioned that was with The Guardian. He didn't just leave it at just athletes speaking out. And he kept making that point. Every single time that we talked or said something, he said, yes, it's important for athletes to speak out. You know, we know the power of their voice and the amount of influence they have. But then he always took it back to, but it's important for everyone to speak out, for everyone to use whatever positions, whatever platforms they have to speak out about what's going on. And it was, you know, I just have a lot of respect for Mahmoud Abdul-Rauf, the way that he brilliantly lays things out and the way that he brings in different quotes just in regular conversation. You know, he'll quote Huey P. Newton and then work it into what he's saying, or he'll, you know, make a reference to J. Edgar Hoover and then keep talking. And it's just he is really brilliant. So that was the topic. And it's interesting because there should be room for this discussion, but they will not have this discussion on regular networks. They will only promote something like Charles Barkley bashing everyone, saying that athletes should do this and they should do this and they're stupid if they don't. And that's a real problem, because we've seen this before in the past, and, you know, with a lot of different topics. There's only one perspective and one presentation that is allowed, but I digress.
No, that's really important to say. I want to say one thing about it, and then I'm actually curious about your thoughts about this, Etan. And Chuck, mm-hmm. by all means, chime in. I hear something in Charles Barkley's comments. First of all, let me be clear about something. Like, I first wrote an article about Charles Barkley's politics in 2003, and I've charted them ever since. And one of the things that you always hear in Charles Barkley, and it's consistent, is that he has said some amazing things about class in the United States, about rich and poor, and about how, I remember he said, people like Bill Gates want to set people against each other because then they're looking at each other instead of the person at the top of the mountain. I remember him talking about that. I remember him speaking out for immigrant rights back when Arizona enacted SB 1070, the first of the papers please laws, where cops could just ask anybody for your papers. And if you don't have them, you could find yourself on a bus or in a, you know, on a chain gang, even in Arizona at that time. I remember him speaking out against that. I remember him speaking out also for LGBTQ rights, which is something you don't hear a lot of, certainly male straight athletes do. But one of the other things, Etan, is that he has consistently also been a critic of Black protest, particularly in the Black Lives Matter movement, and particularly anything that takes aim at police officers on the question of racism, to be specific. He has been really, really rough on those questions in a way that's frankly a little bit odd, given how off it is, like a real contempt, actually, for protesters. Stupid, young, don't know what they're talking about, crazy, you know, in all the ways that Barkley does. And you talk about him not wanting division. What does it say for someone of Barkley's stature to attack Black protest so relentlessly? And I got to say, I hear that in these comments, Etan, because why did the Eagles and frankly other NFL teams boycott the White House in that first Trump term, as did the Golden State Warriors and many other teams as well? Why did they do it? It was because of the racism. It was because he called NFL players SOBs. It was because Kaepernick was kneeling. Kaepernick, another person who Barkley criticized mercilessly. It was those issues, Black protest issues, that turned Barkley against protesters. And I see Barkley looking at this now and thinking like, okay, the reason why the Eagles did it last time was because of Trump's racism. And I'm not down with that being an issue that we raise. Therefore, they should just go to the White House and frankly, kiss the ring of the man who is canceling Black History Month, not to mention 1,001 other racist directives. I mentioned the one about the EEOC earlier, about white, anti-white racism being the number one issue that they need to be dealing with. So much anti-Black executive orders coming out of this administration, giving all this power to apartheid boy Elon Musk to do what he wants to do. You know, I'm trying not to curse, but like offering immigration status to white South African landowners who are being treated badly. I mean, that was a Nazi message board issue on the dark recesses of the internet just a couple years ago. And now it's U.S. policy. It's all a myth, but it's something that stokes his base up mighty nice. And it's a slap in the face to Mandela so much. But to bring it back to you, Etan, what do you think about that analysis that I think this is Barkley's historic anti-Blackness that we're seeing at this moment?
Well, there's certain coded language that he uses sometimes. And you have to just listen. It's the same thing when PK Subban, you remember a little while ago when he was talking about athletes and he started off making a point about the All-Star weekend, and then he ventured to something completely different. You know, then he started saying that, you know, he just added some different things. He's like, you know, these are working class people who spend their hard earned money to see you play. Who is he referring to? You know what I mean? When he says working class people, who is he referring to? You know, when Barkley said, oh, it's causing division, who is he saying that is causing division amongst? Do you know what I mean? Like, what is
point made?
And it's very clear. So when you hear those certain terms, when you hear those certain words being spoken, you know who they're speaking for. You know, exactly. So then everything after that shouldn't come as a surprise. But I do think that there is room for a differing opinion. And that's why I went to Mahmoud Abdul-Rauf. And the thing about what you said as far as Barkley historically kind of having like really strong terms, you know what I mean? Inflammatory terms.
Inflammatory is the good word, yes.
Right, to talk about, to describe any type of Black resistance, and especially athletes or anything like that. And he uses the language of stupid and dumb and ignorant and everything. I mean, even going back to a Kyrie, like Kyrie had no idea what he's talking about. He's just stupid and dumb and ignorant. Like, whoa, could you let Kyrie explain what he's talking about first before you call him stupid, dumb and ignorant? Like it's an immediate thing. So when he uses words like stupid for athletes tonight, he's playing to a certain demographic that will now the opinions and thoughts of the athletes for not going to the White House simply as being they don't know any better. They're just like Charles Barkley said. So he's doing it for a very specific reason.
Yeah, but and I'll just throw in there, but when it was the Phoenix Suns speaking out for immigrant rights, they were not stupid. You know what I'm saying? Like it's reserved for protest around Black issues. And that's the thing that rankles me. And frankly, it makes me wonder if we'll only find this out if we get to sit in on Barkley in the psychiatrist's office or the therapist's office, because he's got a thing about it.
He does.
And it's not uniform across all protests and across all modes of resistance I find to be curious and very upsetting.
Yeah. And it's interesting because then you know, following Barkley, you know, it's important to note that you know, he says so much stuff that I disagree with, you know, so many times, especially when he talks on certain issues. But then you see him, you know, when he's given, you know, $1 million to each to eight different HBCUs. And I remember looking at that before and I was like, huh, would not have expected that. You know what I mean? So, but then you hear him speak afterwards and it's like, wait, the two don't match. You know what I mean? Almost like, is this the same person or is this a different Charles Barkley that did one thing and then is speaking, you know, right after it? And I can't quite, you know, it's where, so right now, a lot of the conversation with LeBron is talking about how, you know, he's criticized the media as far as always bashing the current players. Yeah. And I think there's a lot to that, you know, and inside the NBA is the biggest platform, but you see it whenever the players have any type of thing that has to do with empowerment, with standing up, with any, there's an immediate bash. And I don't understand why is that need, you know what I mean, to do that. And it's, you know, that's why you have to have other perspectives, other opinions, like Mahmoud Abdul-Rauf, who speak up and say the opposite.
Wow. So throw it to you, Chuck, because I've been talking too much in this section. I really appreciate everything that Etan is saying. And frankly, Etan, really appreciate that you spoke to Mahmoud about this. I'll be amplifying your article today off all of my non-Twitter social media. But let me throw it to you, Chuck. What are your general thoughts though about what Chuck is saying? And frankly, and let's remember too, as we talk about this, that Charles Barkley is also still a Philadelphia icon, having played his early years with the Sixers and the Philadelphia Eagles being the Super Bowl champions.
You know, Charles Barkley has been doing this for a long time. And yes, he is very generous and that he's been doing that for a long time. But, you know, these are two different things. And that's not, you know, that's a common trait. But after the Baltimore uprising, he had similar comments. I don't remember what it was, but then he came down to Baltimore and he will sit with people who disagree with him. And he was actually booed when he was on stage. And there was a small little documentary about it. And he's always had this position. But and we also cannot forget, he's also a millionaire. Okay, and sometimes, you know, people become millionaires, you know, they change a lot. They're part of a different class and they're immune from a different class. White people who come up to Charles Barkley are very kind and nice to him. They may not have, you know, continued that way, you know, had he not become a basketball player. Of course, you know, If I look at Bill Maher, who's a millionaire, and I look at him 20 years ago, his what he does and what he's doing now, I mean, the change is pretty incredible. People have a lot of money, and they're going to it's going to change their mind. It's going to change how they see the world. And I don't think they're good ones to go to advice for in general. But I think what's happening now with the government is the same thing that we've always said with celebrities and sports. The three of us have discussed this, should someone speak out or not speak out forever. And I think what's become clear, not just with celebrities, but the Democratic Party, is that we have to take things into our own hands. So somewhere along the line, and there's this line, I don't know where the line is. It goes from two people could question why a celebrity is not speaking out, but one is very active in the community who's questioning it, and another one is not active in the community and questioning it. And for the person who's not active in the community, at what point does it become an evasion of responsibility? At what point does it become, I'm going to hold a basketball player to a higher standard than I will hold myself? And I think we need clarity from all these celebrities who whether they're musicians or sports, whether they're silent, not speaking, and say, they're not going to save us, okay? A Democratic Party is not going to save us. Let's take it into our own hands through boycotts, through mass protest, through striking, through unions, through a whole bunch of other methods besides civic responsibility one day every 2 years, what we've been brainwashed, because the right wing, they are fighting 365 days every year. They fight their own party. If it's not white supremacist enough, they're going to let Trump know about it. But that's not how it is. on the other side. The other one is, okay, come save us. So I think we just have to take matters in our own hands. And if a celebrity comes in, and if we get a Kaepernick or we get someone else, that's a bonus.
Mm.
I would say I don't think it's necessarily about saving. I think it's more of a someone in the public eye. Inspiring. One of the things that Mahmoud talked about, he was like, in the a reality of it is that he was talking about the weight that athletes do carry, and that a lot of people do listen to athletes. But then you have a lot of people who aren't in the circle of activism. You know what I mean? We're talking about people outside the circle of activism who don't pay attention to it the way that we do here, and you know, our listeners on WPFW and everything else. But they listen to and they hear a Charles Barkley speaking. So when he does say something like this, there are people that then give it a lot of credence and a lot. Oh, yeah. You know what I mean? So having that opposing voice is extremely important. But I don't think it's necessarily about saving. But I do think it is about inspiring, because somebody with a platform as big as Charles Barkley, they do have so much influence.
Atan, we completely agree on that. We have to combat that. That's what we do, right? We have to combat if Charles Barkley says, because I get people in my timeline who have really strong racist positions, and they give me a picture of Barkley and a quote like he's Nelson Mandela, the way they put the quote. I'm like, why are you giving me Charles Barkley like he's a big freedom fighter? And they do that. So we do have to combat it in those spaces. We have to write the articles like you are writing. So I don't think that's the part that I am saying. Mm-hmm. I'm not talking about the people who are fighting, and we have to go in all of those spaces: music, sports, film. We have to fight in those battlegrounds. That's what we do every week here at WPFW on The Collision. That's the basis of what we do. I think what I'm saying is there is a small portion, or I don't know how big the portion of people are, that aren't active, that they're waiting for someone else to save them when the people who will save us are working. Join an organization. Find out where the local protest is. Find some lane that works for you. More than ever before, we need people to get active.
Amen to that. And, you know, we only have a few more minutes. That's actually a great segue, Chuck, if perhaps you can speak to us about some of what has been happening so people know that their ability to push back is not just like this abstraction, but something real.
Yeah. You know, there are these little nuggets of progress that you see, and they're not that always that little. But I think one of the things we have to do, we have to start with the workers, because workers have power, you know, withholding labor and whatnot. So even last week, after 46 days, there were 5,000 nurses in Providence, Oregon's largest healthcare system. They had a successful strike for 46 days. They got 20 to 42% wage increases and many other benefits. That's not going to be on CNN. At around the same exact time, Philly Whole Foods, what was the only second time workers beat Amazon to form a union. And I don't think people understand how hard it is to beat Amazon. They throw everything and the kitchen sink at you to avoid a union. People should see the documentary Union with Christian Smalls. That's the first one. And that's a great documentary. Starbucks Union in Western and Waveland, Chicago, they just started. So those are some of the union victories that are happening. We're seeing some union solidarity. If you want to talk about Free Palestine, McDonald's has been having a horrible, worst sales drop since the pandemic. And there are many examples where boycotts do work. The economy in Israel is declining. It's almost like the billions that are being sent from the U.S. is making up for some of that. But a lot of the boycott, the BDS, is working. And we have to continue that. And people have to be reminded of that, because you can't stop that. And then you even could go to other countries that we should think about and emulate, that may be protesting a little bit harder. You're talking about Ontario Teachers Pension Plan. They had divestment of two weapons manufacturers, North Grumman and Textron, last month. They got those companies to divest as part of their teachers' pension plan. And there are not many of those, but there are a few of those. And if you get a few of those, it means you could have a few more if you organize the right way. And in the future, I'm gonna talk about some DC victories that I do believe will be on the horizon if we organize the right way and if we get it together. So, you know, so it's not all bad. people are starting to realize their own power. Now, the right wing understands their power. For the first time, I think people fighting for human rights are starting to understand that.
Amen to that. Well, we're just about out of time. Any last thoughts, Atan, other than everybody out there should read your Guardian article where you talk to Mahmoud Abdul-Rauf? Any other thoughts, sir?
Oh, no, no. Great discussion as always, fellas. Great discussion.
Great. An important discussion. Chuck, what about you, sir?
Repeat the question again, DZ?
Oh, just anything. We're about to go, man. Just if you had any last words or thoughts.
Is it Stay Frosty? I wouldn't be mad I didn't have something with more substance, but I'm going to go with Stay Frosty. Isn't that what you say, DZ?
That sure is. Everybody out there, stay frosty. And remember, WPFW is indispensable as an institution in this political moment. So spread the word, support the station, and make sure everybody you know listens in, because we are trying to change the world one broadcast at a time.
I don't want to write this down. I want to tell you how I feel right now. I don't want to take no time to write this down. I want to tell you how I feel right now. Hey, tomorrow may never come. For you or me, life is not promised. Tomorrow may never show up. For you and me, this life is not promised.
On Saturday, March 8th, beginning at midnight for 24 hours, WPFW presents One Heart, One Fight, One Sisterhood, visioning justice, freedom, peace, and security for the women of the world in commemoration of International Women's Day. The programming will center the voices of women and girls protecting their communities and resisting imperialism, racism, xenophobia, and homophobia across the globe. That's One Heart, One Fight, One Sisterhood. Visioning justice, freedom, peace, and security for the women of the world. Saturday, March 8th, beginning at midnight. WPFW, building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
For close to 50 years, WPFW has amplified the voices, told the stories, and shared the history and culture of Black people throughout the diaspora. In short, we are Black history. Black is WPFW. Texting WPFWFM to 801-801 will help to protect this medium in the Black radical tradition so that we can continue to chronicle Black hope, sorrow, and resistance.
Greetings. WPFW is pleased to announce the relaunch of our major donor program, now known as the Jazz and Justice Circle. If you gave $1,000 last year or so far this year, you are automatically enrolled in this cherished group of listener members, and we thank you. Benefits of your membership are at WPFWFM.org under the Support Us tab at the top of the homepage is the Jazz and Justice Circle. Interested in joining this select group? Please consider a donation of $1,000 or more online at WPFWFM.org. Your donation helps WPFW build a better world, one broadcast at a time.
Wondering how to get WPFW swag in your life? Items that say, I support Jazz and Justice without saying a word. We've got you covered. Details and browsing at WPFWFM.org. Again, that's WPFWFM.org.
Hello, I am Von Martin, host of Caribbeana here on Saturdays, 6 p.m. until 9 p.m. on WPFW. For the 48 years I've been on WPFW Radio, I do feel so humbled with the response of you, our listening audience, with your wonderful reaction to our fundraising efforts. On behalf of the staff and management and the volunteers who continue to bring you excellent programming of jazz and jazz extensions with strong public affairs and relevant news, I say thank you.